This is Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, a podcast and radio program presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. Most any contemporary musical style can trace its roots back to the blues. Time Signatures explores the blues and its musical connections with captivating interviews, lively discussions, and news from the world of the blues.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up and down these Michigan roads, yeah.
And now, here he is, your host, Jim Irvin.
Well, thank you so much, Parker, and welcome to Time Signatures. I'm your host, Jim Irvin. And our guest today is a Chicago native, so you know this is going to be a fun episode. He started singing around the age of 5, and the bug to perform stuck with him throughout his youth. He began his singing career in his teens and pursued his dreams of doing what he loved to do, singing and entertaining. He has a couple of CDs out there, and we are pleased to have time to talk to him today. Christopher Henderson, welcome to Time Signatures, man. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I appreciate your time, man, and I want to dive right in here because there's so much to talk about, but I'd love for you to talk about your earliest memories of music.
Okay. Well, my earliest memories came from home, growing up around a lot of blues lovers, jazz lovers in my family. My family migrated from Mississippi. My grandparents, my maternal grandparents and paternal grandparents, my great aunts and uncles. So I grew up around a lot of older relatives, and we always had, you know, parties and gatherings, and they would play the blues, Muddy Waters and B.B. King, Howlin' Wolf, you name it, everybody was playing in our house. So I just kind of picked up from that, you know, the emotion of blues, how my family reacted, the singing, the dancing, you know. So it started young at home. Yeah,
you know, that influence, when I was growing up, you and I are cut from similar cloth, because I was also exposed to a lot of the older music, going way back to the big band and the swing years. But how did that first generation of blues music influence you as you began to develop a taste for it?
Well, I just used to mimic the records and stuff, the songs that were being played. And so my mother, she realized that as a young boy, that I had a gift, that it was just bigger than just singing along with the record. She's like, oh man, you know, my son can sing, he's very talented, because I used to sound like a lot of the artists, you know. So she would have me perform for the family, they would come over, and I had to put on performances for my relatives. So that's how I really knew there's something that I can do, and I wanted to do it professionally.
There you go. Now, at the age of 5, you got your first taste of singing around the house, as you just talked about. And you also got some impromptu opportunities to cash in, didn't you?
I did. When I was about 16 is when I really started to gain an audience and to sing like live in front of an audience with different musicians and stuff. I had went to a blues jam on the west side of Chicago. They used to have blues jams, and my mother volunteered me to go, her and my aunts. And they did have an intermission, and they asked, did anyone want to sing? You know, anybody know the blues and want to sing the blues? So my mother's like, yeah, my son, you know, they looked at me like, this kid, you know, what's he going to, they thought I was going to rap or something like that, you know. But
right.
I took the microphone, and like they say, the rest is history. The people, they were blown away by my talent. They didn't know that was coming from a little kid, you know. So that was, and then I started to get paid for, you know, weekly. So that was like the first professional gig for me.
Now, I want to step back and flesh that story out just a little bit, because I want to hear your story about your connection to then Chicago Alderman Wallace Davis.
Okay.
How did that connection come to be?
I actually met him that day when I went, because it was at the Catfish Corner, which was his establishment, and we would have live blues there. So I was singing on the stage, and he came out of the restaurant, him and his wife, who since had passed. My condolences to him and their family, but him and his wife came out of the restaurant while I was singing, and he stopped the band, he stopped everything, the musicians, the people. He said, wait a minute, who is this little boy? You know, you mean to tell me this is a little boy out here singing? And asked me my name and where I was from. He was in awe, you know. He's like, oh my God, you know. He just, and so he took a liking to me, and he kind of like mentored me a few years, because I'd done that for a few years. So that was the day that I met him. He came out of the restaurant, you know, seeing me in action. So he was surprised. He called me the Michael Jackson of the blues, you know, then. So, yeah. But yeah, so that was a cool experience. Yep.
And what song did you sing that first time on stage?
My first song was Bobby Blue Bland. I'm a big Bobby Blue Bland fan, especially during that time. And I sung I Pity the Fool. I did like a medley. Then I did Further On Up the Road. Those were the songs that I kind of did, yeah.
Okay. Now, Chris, I love that you have such an eclectic taste in the blues. I always describe the blues as a buffet because there's so many little subsets involved in it. And quite frankly, I take the plate and I just put what I want on there, and that's what you need to do, you know?
Yeah, but absolutely.
After reading that article from 2020 in the Living Blues magazine, I've added a couple of names to my blues list, and I want to thank you for that.
Okay.
Some of the early blues influences that you had. But talk about your musical taste, if you would, please.
Well, yeah.
Throw some of them OGs in there, man, because you got to keep them names out there.
I'm well-rounded. It started, I used to collect records. My mother would give us allowance, so that started at very, very young. I started collecting at like 12 years old, and I would collect like blues from the 1920s, like Bessie Smith, Ma Rainey, King Oliver, you know, with jazz, all those people from like New Orleans and the South. I was really fascinated. And it was just something about that deep, deep blues, like from the 20s and the 30s, you know, you would thought that that's what I'll be doing now, but I'm very well-rounded. But those people inspired me the most just because it was different to me and it was new to me, you know, at that time. So yeah, like those are the blues. I like Sister Rosetta, just a lot of those type of people, you know, that I started to collect early on, you know.
Well, and I think that, you know, the older, and by the way, Bessie Smith and Ma Rainey are two of the names that I added to my list. And I actually went and bought some CDs of them today, in fact, while I was preparing for the interview, because I wanted to rework it a little bit. But I have to tell you, I love the older stuff. But as I've heard so many times before, I believe it was Muddy Waters that might have said that you pick up the blues where you find it and you carry it a little bit further on down the road and you do your own thing with it. One of the things that I respect most about a lot of the blues artists today is that's exactly what y'all are doing. It doesn't have to be in a cookie cutter box where you just have to do everything the same way, do you?
You're right about that. So true. And that's what I try to bring with my artistry and my blues, because I do traditional blues, I do soul blues, and I just put it all in the pot and I just give everybody a little bit of everything, you know, for everybody.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
See, and I like a little bit of that soul blues, man. There's something about it. And honestly, the longer that I'm in this, doing this program, the more I'm learning about the different aspects and the different subsets of the genre, I'm going to be honest. I just recently learned about soul blues.
Okay.
Because I'm familiar with hill country blues. I'm familiar with Memphis blues, Chicago blues, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. The list goes on. But there are so many different subsets, and each of these subsets brings something new to the table, don't they?
Absolutely, you're so correct. Oh, like soul blues, you have Bobby Bland and B.B. King and those type of artists versus, you know, Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf. It's the same, but it's not the same, because, you know, it's different generations and they bring something new to it. So, yeah.
One of the things that I like about that is, you know, you get people like B.B. who flows freely between the soul blues and some of the more traditional forms of the genre.
Uh-huh.
And I think that you've got a lot of people, even in Chicago today, Taranzo Cannon, Mike Wheeler, John Primer.
Yeah.
They all, even though they're Chicago blues, they bring a little twist, don't they?
Yes, absolutely. Yep. They put their signature it. They put their own spin on it.
Right there. Time Signatures, man. They put their signature on it.
There you go.
There's a gentleman over here in the southwest corner of the state of Michigan. He goes by the nickname of Mississippi Mick. His name is Mick Colossa. And he describes his version of the blues as free range blues because he's everywhere.
Okay. I like that. I like that.
He lived down in the hill country area down near Clarksdale. If people give it a chance, there are so many different avenues that the blues can take you. Am I correct in that?
You're so correct. Absolutely.
Now, obviously, at the time of this article's publication, we were dealing with the COVID pandemic.
Yes.
Chris, are you finding that things are kind of returning to a certain level of normalcy nowadays?
Yes, absolutely. Right before the pandemic, I had a lot of different opportunities to do shows and to go overseas, you know, and then right when it was going to happen, you know, the pandemic just dropped me flat on my face, you know. So I feel like now is the time that things are picking back up. It's time to get on out there. So yes, I do.
Good. I've talked to so many people. Of course, we all went through the COVID pandemic. We were all locked up for, you know, for the better part of a year or a little more. What did you do during that time? Because obviously at that time you were kind of on a trajectory upward, weren't you?
Yes. I just focused on the music. I drowned myself in the music. I did a lot of writing songs because I write a lot of mostly everything that I do, I write. I started to do that early on as well as a teen, writing different little songs and melodies. So I did a lot of writing during the pandemic. I did release my second project right at the tail end of the pandemic. So a lot of those, that project kind of came from the pandemic. It was during that time.
Okay. Now, I guess when you were writing during the pandemic, did you record at that time during that that period?
I did, yes. I did the song Made No Sense. I did a cover of Ain't Nobody's Business. I did that during the pandemic, yes.
Okay. I was going to ask if that period of time had a bit of a sway on your music at that time and your writing, if some of that made its way into the album.
It did, mm-hmm. Yeah, the song, It Don't Make No Sense, that was really pertaining to the pandemic.
Okay, well, talk about that a little bit.
You know, it was a pandemic, and then I felt like during that time, it made it harder for people to, you know, live their, of course, everyday life, their livelihood. So it was just it just didn't make sense to me. So that's why I named the song, It Don't Make No Sense. You know, people are walking around. You had people who were struggling during that time on top of a pandemic. So it was just a lot of inflation. It was just a lot of everyday life hardships included with the pandemic. You know, that's basically what that speaks of.
And I remember that time so vividly because, number one, I'm in my late 50s. Number two, of course, I was mid-50s back then. Number two, I am also a type 2 diabetic.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, and there were a lot of people that had pre-existing conditions such as that that were really scared, I mean, you know, for their lives.
Yes, absolutely.
And, so they didn't want to be out. They didn't want to be anywhere near anybody. And I remember coming home with grocery bags. I had, at the time, we had 8 people living here. All 3 of my kids. I had a nephew. I had a gentleman that I was renting a room to. My husband was here. I mean, 8 people in this house, okay? And I was the guy that was going out doing the shopping. And I remember coming home and wiping the bags off on the porch with, with wipes just to make sure that, you know, I wasn't bringing stuff into the house. But it feels good that we're past that. And and it's nice to be back out there among the public and being able to go to concerts and all kinds of stuff.
Yes, it is. That was so depressed. That was a depressed. I kind of fell into a depressed because I didn't get a chance to promote my album like I wanted to. I couldn't go out and do shows. I couldn't. It was like a standstill. So I kind of, I won't say regret, but I wish I would have waited to release it so I can do more with it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, and, you know, and the thing is, I think depression was a big part of that time. I'm a very social person, and I have become considerably less social than I am than I have been in the past.
Okay.
And I think a lot of it is due to the COVID pandemic and all that. But
I agree.
I want to flip the page here, Chris, and I want to talk about something else. How is your collection of Living Blues magazines going?
It's going good. I got them packed away now, but they're going well. I'm still collecting them. I think my oldest one is from 1990 or 89, I believe.
I'm going to tell you, you need to look on eBay, and I'm going to tell you why, because I found one. Of course, I'm sure you've heard about the 1969 Ann Arbor Blues Festival.
I did, yes.
Okay, I've got the albums. I have the CDs. I I actually have a couple, and I wish I could put my hands on them right now because I'd show it to you, but I have the Living Blues magazine that has all the pictures from that event.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, and I found it on eBay, and it was like $7, $8, something like that. So if you want to get some of that older stuff, go check it out.
Okay, most definitely.
Chris, we have to talk about what you've been doing lately, man. Are you working on any more stuff on the music front? Do you have a new album in the works or a tour coming up? What's going on?
Yes, I got a couple of things coming up. I did want to plug my latest release, a re-release actually, of a performance, a live performance that I did of a few years ago. Chris Henderson live at Moe's Tavern. You can order at elasticstage.com. So this is the album.
Ooh, is that vinyl?
Yes, it is.
Christopher Henderson, you got vinyl?
I got vinyl.
you know, I gotta listen. On April 8th last year, I had no vinyl. Okay. On today, April the 3rd, not even a year later, I have over 400 pieces of vinyl, and more than half of it is blues.
Really?
Trust me when I tell you, my friend, I will be pre-ordering that tomorrow. I promise you.
Okay, yes. Tomorrow you can pre-order at elasticstage.com, and then it will be available April 28th. So this is the vinyl.
Beautiful, okay. Man. That is so cool. Now
this is a 12-inch vinyl. It's double-sided. It's 8 minutes on each side. And the reason why I'm releasing it is because Moe's Tavern was going back to the pandemic. They shut down due to the pandemic.
Okay.
And the owner passed of COVID. 19.
Oh, man.
And she was a beautiful lady. She gave me a platform to showcase blues. And I did a show February the 16th, 2018. And this is what this vinyl is.
Wow. Yes.
So you can pre-order again.
I was going to say, and how much is this?
So the vinyl is $29.99 for the U.S.
Okay.
And then overseas is $27.99.
Okay. All right, very good. And we will definitely put a link up in the information section of this episode so that people can go in there and they can get that episode or that that album and order it for their own. Now,
yeah,
Chris,
so I'm excited. This is my first vinyl release, so I'm and I love vinyl. I have quite a collection as well, so I'm just excited about it. I'm excited.
Yeah, I don't know what it is about vinyl. I've got this illness, I think.
Look, see, that's how I was growing up, you know, collecting and going to the record shop, spending all my money on vinyl.
But you know, as I was reading that article, Chris, you brought me back to the days when I was 11, 12 years old, and I'd run down to this little corner store called Harry's Amusements. Mm-hmm. And it was about seven blocks from our house. And I would run down there, and this is back when a 45 was like a buck and a half. Okay. I got my first album of Elvis Presley, and I can't remember the name of it, but I have a copy of it over there.
Okay.
And I bought that from Lucky's Amusements over on the west side of town when I was at my grandmother's bakery that she was working at.
Okay.
I don't know why I ever got away from it, but I have to tell you, I have a vintage PL518 Pioneer over here. I know this is geek talk for some of you. It's an incredible direct drive turntable that has been totally refurbished from 1978.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It's almost 50 years old. Well, it's not my original. This is what I just picked up within the last year.
Okay. Okay.
And so, I mean, I got a nice piece of equipment to listen to my stuff on.
Okay.
And I'm using an Ortofon stylus, which is high dollar, but it's I'm telling you, the quality and listening to the clicks and the pops and the white noise and, you know, that whole thing about pulling the thing out of the vinyl out of the sleeve. It's incredible.
Right, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, Chris, here's your moment to shine, man. Where can people go to find out more about you, maybe pick up that album, some merchandise, or even book you for a gig?
Okay. Well, you can find me on Facebook, Chris D. Henderson. That's my artist page. So all of my upcoming shows, live performances, anything that's new and updated with me, you can find it there, Chris D. Henderson on Facebook. as well as Christopher Henderson on Instagram. You can book me at chrishendersonbooking@gmail.com. You can pick up the vinyl pre-order, like I said, starts tomorrow, elasticstage.com, and it'll be available April 28th, elasticstage.com, same website, and you can order it from there. I will have hard copies next month, so if anyone would like to reach out to me and have them signed and I can send them out, they can have that option as well. I am releasing a new single called Heartbreak Blues, Blues Heartbreak, and that will be released later this month, April.
Very cool. So you got a lot going on, man.
Oh, yeah, man. I try not to let the grass grow under my feet. I try to keep it moving.
Good thing to do, man.
Yeah.
Christopher Henderson, it has been a pleasure, my friend. Thank you so much for joining me today on Time Signatures, and I genuinely look forward to meeting up with you down the road.
Most definitely. Thank you so much. I appreciate for all that you do for blues artists and what you do, giving us a platform and your contribute to the blues. Much appreciated. And I'm looking forward to meeting you one day.
Yes, sir. Well, thank you so much. That means a lot. And before we wrap up here, I want to remind you that it takes an estimated 5,000 music streams to raise the equivalent of a $20 CD. Now, I couldn't believe that either, but I've made it my policy to buy music from the artist first, and then and only then I will stream from the various platforms. I mean, if we want live music out there, we owe it to them to spend our hard-earned cash and supporting their music and merch. Trust me when I tell you, they will thank you every single time. And thank you for your consideration, folks. And that concludes this edition of Time Signatures. Once again, my thanks to our guest, Chris Henderson, but also to you, for without you, none of this would be possible. Jim Irvin reminding you, keeping the blues alive is everyone's responsibility, but preserving the history of the blues one story at a time, that's my mission. Until next time, so long, everybody.
This has been Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. For more information on CABS, visit capitalareablues.org. You can find this episode and past episodes at lccconnect.org. The Time Signatures theme song, Michigan Roads, is used by permission and was written by Root Doctor, featuring Freddie Cunningham.
You know I'm trying, trying, baby, driving up in
Until next time, keep on keeping the blues alive.
Examining the issues and topics that affect our lives from the local level to the world stage. Listen to the programs of LCC Connect anytime at lccconnect.org.
LCC Connect. Voices. Vibes. Vision.
The stage is alive and well at Lansing Community College. Each year, the downtown campus comes to life with more than 30 performances at Dart Auditorium, the Black Box Theater, and LCC's Outdoor Amphitheater. These productions are more than entertainment. They're part of the learning experience. Students in LCC's Performing Arts program gain hands-on experience, both on stage and behind the scenes, developing confidence, creativity, and collaboration. From powerful plays to lively concerts, LCC's performances celebrate local talent and the vibrant spirit of the arts in our community. All performances are free. Find out what's next at lcc.edu/showinfo.
Hi, I'm Greg Ladig, and I host a show called Stars on Sports with Assistant Athletic Director Stephen Cutter here on LCC Connect. It's all about Lansing Community College Athletic Department. You can always find out more about Stars on Sports and listen on demand at lccconnect.org.
Aloha! I'm Ben Hassinger, Michigan's ukulele ambassador and founder of Mighty Uke Day, a celebration of the diminutive yet dynamic ukulele. This year, we'll be kicking things off with a special fundraiser on Saturday, April 11th at the Sir Pizza Old Town Pub. The day begins with our monthly morning meeting of Laugh, the Lansing Area Ukulele Group, followed by concerts, group strums, open mic, a silent auction, and plenty of ukulele fun. Scheduled performers include the Ukulele Kings, Vinyl Resting Place, the PT Strummers, and others to be announced. We'll also be recording the Mighty Uke Day 16 theme song for a viral video release. Join us for this celebration of strumming and singing, Saturday, April 11th at the Sir Pizza Old Town Pub. Proceeds for the Mighty Uke Day benefit the nonprofit Music is the Foundation. For more information and advanced tickets, visit MightyUkeDay.com. That's MightyUkeDay.com.
Returning to school can be a challenge. If you're a recent high school grad, a new Michigan Reconnect participant at LCC, or a GED holder, we want to help you succeed with extra support in reading, writing, and math. LCC's Coalition for College and Career Readiness presents College Connect, a four-week, no-cost initiative created to prepare students with the tools needed to succeed at LCC. College Connect begins in July, but seating is limited. To find deadline and enrollment information, visit lcc.edu/cc.
LCC.
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
This is Amy Wagoner from the Historical Society of Michigan with a Michigan History Moment. They were German prisoners of war. They had survived combat in North Africa and Europe, but they died in Michigan. During the Second World War, Michigan hosted about 6,000 enemy prisoners of war, mostly Germans and Italians, as part of a national system that processed 425,000 prisoners in all. Prisoners of war started coming to Michigan in mid-1943. They lived in Michigan's system of 32 base and subcamps and worked voluntarily at jobs that were deemed not war-related. That included farm labor and working in food processing factories. In 1944, prisoners of war composed one-third of Michigan's agricultural labor force. They were paid for their work in scrip redeemable at the camp canteens. One of the prisoner of war camps was Camp Blissfield, located in southeastern Michigan's Lenawee County, near the Ohio state line. The war was over, with the prisoners awaiting repatriation to Germany. On the afternoon of October 31st, 1945, 24 prisoners piled into an army truck for the ride back to camp from the Raymond Beck Farm. The truck approached a railroad crossing a half mile from camp. The truck driver never saw the oncoming New York Central Railroad passenger train. It slammed into the truck at full speed. 16 German prisoners and their American guard were killed. The driver was injured, but survived. An investigation found that weeds and tree branches had hidden the oncoming train from his view. The prisoners had planned a Halloween party for that evening. Back at camp, their homemade masks and costumes went unworn, and few of them could eat the special meal that the cooks had prepared. The bodies were sent for burial to the main Michigan camp, Camp Custer, near Battle Creek. Three funeral services took place on November 3rd, one Lutheran, one Catholic, and one for the men who had declared themselves non-religious. Funeral services took place on Sunday, November 4, at Camp Blissfield. Local clergymen officiated, and one of the prisoners, who was a musician, played a violin solo of Ave Maria. The German's senior officer then called the men to attention and read the names of the dead. Then an eight-man firing party fired three volleys. Nearby, work stopped at the Great Lakes Sugar Company, where American and German workers alike paused for a minute of silence. The German soldiers still rest in the Camp Custer Cemetery, where mourning ceremonies are conducted every November. This Michigan History Moment was brought to you by MichiganHistoryMagazine.org.
Featuring the faculty, staff, students, and others that helped to make Lansing's premier college what it is today. LCC Connect, Mid-Michigan's connection to Lansing Community College. To find out more about our featured programs or to listen on demand, visit us at lccconnect.org.
LCC
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
Lansing Community College Performing Arts presents 1984 by George Orwell, adapted for the stage by Nick Hearn. Winston Smith has been in prison for committing thought crimes against Big Brother. As part of his re-education, he is forced to relive key moments from his past, reenacting his mistakes alongside other thought criminals so that all may learn from his failure, especially his greatest crime of all, falling in love with Julia. George Orwell's 1984 remains a powerful and chilling vision of life under totalitarianism, set against a world of surveillance, control, and fear. Featured in LCC's Dart Auditorium, April 10th through the 12th, and April 17th and 18th. All performances are free to attend. Visit lcc.edu/showinfo for showtime details.
Feeling froggy? Well, leap into 20-plus podcasts at lccconnect.org.
Art Happens Here, the podcast that explores the often curious and occasionally amazing art installations on, in, and around the campuses of Lansing Community College. I'm your host, Bruce Mackley.
Listen to this program and many others on demand at lccconnect.org.
What is dedication?
My daughter started making necklaces. She makes what we call affirmation fashion. I tell her every day that your black is beautiful. Your black is beautiful. And if there's anything better than being beautiful, it's being smart. If there's anything better than being smart, it's being kind. And reaffirming that every day is our method of making sure her chin never drops. My dad wasn't around, and I remember riding a bike and falling off and cutting myself, and me never would just want to get back on it. People ask, how your children learn how to ride a bike, and you didn't. I didn't teach them. I just created an environment where they taught themselves, and all I had to do was be there.
That's dedication. Visit fatherhood.gov to hear more. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
The Adult Enrichment Program offers massage for beginners, giving participants the opportunity to learn how to ease tension for a partner, comfort a family member, or simply learn a new skill. This non-credit course teaches basic massage techniques and the healing power of touch. More information is available at lcc.edu/keeplearning.
LCC.
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
It's time for Stars on Sports,
a podcast radio show dedicated to sharing stories about our athletic program at LCC, past and present.
Lansing Community College Athletics has a strong tradition.
25 national championships.
Over 190 All-Americans.
19 MCCAA All-Sports trophies.
Stars on Sports will introduce you to individuals that have contributed to our program's success and give you the backstory on what it takes to develop it.
We'll also dive into and break down the topics and issues facing athletic departments across the nation and right here at LCC.
This is Stars on Sports.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Stars on Sports. I'm joined today by our A-team Assistant Athletic Director, Stephen Cutter, and our producer, Dedalion Lowry. And gentlemen, you know, it seems like in the past we've talked about words that I've asked you, is it positive or negative? And I think I found another one today that I think fits that mold, and I like to see which direction we go with it. And it's actually a word I'm not even sure, you know, I really know the definition of it or get it confused with some other words, and it's ego. And we deal with egos in sports, and like many things we've talked about, it can be good or it can be bad. And I think the word ego has a negative kind of tone to it. But having said that, in sports, you know, and you and I have had a lot of conversation in our office that it's you need an ego to be, you know. And again, well, I'd like to talk a little bit about difference between confidence and ego. But what do you think of ego, positive or negative? Or
the best artists create the best work when they do it for themselves.
Man, he's
feeling philosophical.
Can you say that again, please?
The best artists create the best work
when they do it for themselves. We all have egos. Mm-hmm. It's part of the muscle between our ears, and sometimes they can run wild, and you know, sometimes people can keep them in check, but as you like to, the word you like to use, balance.
It is. That's the key word.
So it's
moderation. Everything in moderation.
It's somewhere in there.
That is a great quote. I'm glad you started with that because about doing for themselves. But I want Dedalian to chime. We didn't let Dedalian chime in early last week.
That's all right. I'm fine with that because I don't have an overinflated ego, and I'm good with that. But me too. As far as ego goes, it goes so many different ways. I guess I think of instantly of the many times because of my music background. Very often I talk to people and they talk about a singer in a band that they don't like because he's got such or she's got such a big ego. Okay. And I go, yes, but it takes that ego to do what they're doing. And they kind of need that to front that band. That having been said, I'm not somebody that I necessarily feel like I have a big ego, but it's not to say that I don't. It kind of relates to confidence. Mm-hmm. You know, confidence and ego kind of go hand in hand.
Very much so.
They do. And I wasn't even sure the difference in the definition of confidence and ego, but I did find it. Confidence is inner certainty and trust in your abilities, where ego is a sense of self-importance driven by the need for external validations, which I think is very
interesting.
Important and superiority. But again, good segues. Yes, Dedalian, I agree with you. I think people do struggle with those that do have big egos, but I think the one that do it best have it but keep it in check. You know, humility is like the opposite word I kind of think of, and you know, that's the word I really like, that I think leaders have to be humble or demonstrate humility. So I think the ego part is just keeping it in check. But to your point, the best athlete, the best musician, the best in any field, probably their ego is probably what's helped get them there because of their identity of excelling in that particular spectrum that they excel in. And to your quote, yeah, I mean, we talk about, like, especially in sports, how a lot of kids play because their parents want mm-hmm. them to play. But if you're all in on something, you have to do it for yourself. And to that why that quote is huge in my mind, is because the best ones do have that inner self. And I think that balance of confidence and ego.
Well, I think when you're talking about that, though, then, you know, based on the definitions that you've given, it's almost like it kind of goes more into confidence in that manner, because you said that ego requires the external validation. Is that the definition?
That was part of this particular definition.
Especially since there's so many different definitions of ego.
Right, right. But where it fits in is it's a sense of yourself. It's your identity. And, you know, we're going to talk about, we had a nice podcast in our office yesterday on identity, that we're going to take that word and just do a whole podcast on it. But where ego fits in sports is self-belief, mm-hmm. Desire to be the best. And it does. It's kind of fed by the confidence in your own ability. And, you know, ego can be what drives someone to say, give me the ball, put me on the mound at the end of the game. Let me be the goalie we talked about performance under pressure in previous ones.
And it's still the external validation thing that comes in, but you'll see with high performers or people that are more comfortable in pressure situations, they already have that belief system in themselves, and they're going to get that external validation because they perform well when the building's on fire. So it's not necessarily a searching for it. It happens because they're doing well with whatever it might be.
And we'll get to that, because I also think, again, the external validation is what leads to a overused ego. Because you're right, it can feel greatness or get in the way of it. And it is a motivator. It's refusing to settle. It's refusing to lose. And the other word I think ego gets confused with is arrogance. And that's, again, what we've talked about, I think, Dedalian, when someone is arrogant, yeah. That's when they kind of put people off.
So would you say that Muhammad Ali had a big ego, or was he arrogant?
I would say both. because he excelled because of his ego, he was a little arrogant. I mean, I liked him, but he put people off because, you know, he complained, "I'm the greatest in the world."
So it's not necessarily the ego people have a problem with, it's the arrogance, right?
Yeah, but I think ego leads to too much ego is when it becomes arrogant.
They're similar. Arrogance is the display of superiority or self-importance characterized by overbearing pride and contempt for others.
Just came up with that right off the top of his head.
Overriding belief system that somewhat turns.
Yeah, and the ego, you need ego, back to what we've talked about, to say, I belong here, I'm capable of doing it,
right.
I'm going to prove them wrong. So,
what great sports person that's played sports, that's been labeled as a great ambassador for sports, doesn't have what we're talking about right now?
Yeah. I don't think none.
You can't name any
because Michael Jordan, Serena Williams.
It's a prerequisite for that.
It is.
Kind of stuff.
I mean, they have an ego. But I think because sportsmanship is so important to me, the ones that have the biggest ego but keep it in check are my favorite student athletes or my favorite athlete. The ones, and I like Muhammad Ali too, but the ones that come across as arrogant and don't keep their ego in check are the ones that I probably disassociate a little bit. And I think, to your point, it does turn people. That if their ego gets to arrogance, it does turn people off. But
it's kind of like Charles Barkley, what he used to say, I'm not a role model.
Well, I would disagree.
Do you remember that, though?
I do, and I like Charles Barkley.
He was a basketball player, you know, and so it kind of lines into that. I think that the people that have accomplished extreme success aren't necessarily so worried about what other people are thinking about their ego.
And we're talking about seeing people with ego. I also want to hit on, you know, dealing with kids with egos on your team. And again, I think it's a positive thing because our best players have, I think, been proven to have them. It can help them be bold. It can help them be a little more fearless. It helps with identity, which, again, we're not going to go into.
Somewhat delusional.
Somewhat. Because it's almost to it's actually a word I'm starting to like even more, because, as you know, one of my favorite things is go to the line, touch the line. If you go over the line, you're hurting yourselves. If you go under the line, you're hurting yourselves. And ego is a great word, that if you don't have enough ego, you're not getting to the line. Mm-hmm. If you have too much ego, it's probably hurting you, but you have to get to touch that line to be successful, to train like a pro. You know, and even in handling adversity and failure. And I think that's where ego gets confused a little bit, is I think the ones that have a healthy ego use it as fuel. The ones that don't, it becomes an excuse. They become defensive. But I think as we deal with student-athletes, as coaches and administrators, we got to help them use it to push them forward. And if we don't keep it in check, then it becomes a negative for our team. So let's talk about the negative part of it a little bit, because I just hit on it a little bit. And again, Dedalion, you hit on, like, when we sit back and see someone with a big ego, but when we're dealing with kids with egos, they're probably usually selfish. They blame others.
They're focused on themselves.
They are focused on them, which, again, to your quote, though,
which is really
hard. Right.
Which is really a hard thing in a team environment. When you want a team that has high belief systems and high belief systems in themselves, but then you also want a team that's selfless and is willing to give to others as much as they give to themselves. So you have to really work on that.
And you do. And I think the one that part of the thing that leads to ego is there hasn't been that accountability partner that we've talked about in the past, that no one's held them in check. Because, like, one of the quotes I've heard that it sticks with me is when a coach told me that I'd rather put out a fire than start a fire. And what they meant by that is I'd rather try and reel someone in that has a lot of motivation than trying to get somebody to do something that they're not motivated to do. And I think that's true with ego. I'd rather reel someone in with a high ego than try and get someone that doesn't have an ego to get where they want to be. And again, we know it's a muscle too that you can train and teach them and, you know, help build their confidence to have an ego. But I truly believe those with the highest ego have not been checked, haven't been held accountable, haven't been called out on their actions. And I think it's pretty prevalent in sport because of highlight reels. And, you know, we put so much emphasis on their identity through their success as a student athlete. So it's a catch-22 that we're feeding into their ego and we're not reeling it in, especially some of the most successful student athletes that have been successful at a young age that their athleticism has paved their way and they haven't been held accountable in some of the other things that they should be, such as being a good teammate.
I think history shows us with some of the best athletes at the collegiate level, professional level, they weren't necessarily the best teammates until they ran into coaches that were able to teach them how the importance of that and that they could actually get further than just climbing the mountain on their own.
And someone checked them in. And I believe Michael Jordan had that same thing where he wasn't a great teammate at the beginning of his pro career, but Phil Jackson gets a lot of credit for helping with that and building a team because, great point, you can't, even though your quote says you do it for yourself, but you can't do it without others. Again, a lot of research about the importance of social interaction and how important having that is to be successful in life now. That's where I believe ego gets a negative connotation, is because it gets in the way of that. If you have a large ego, I think it can impact your relationships with your team or with your community per se. So it is up to the coach or adult or someone to help keep that ego in check. And again, so in the end, it's really about managing it and keeping it in check. And some of the ways to do that is focus on the team. Again, we do give individual credit, but I think, you know, some of those, they've received too much individual credit. Being coachable, is important. Reminding, you know, that the growth mindset, I think of a fixed mindset a little bit with ego, because they almost think they're too good, they're better, they don't need to hustle, or they rely on their athleticism to, again, the ones that aren't, that have gone unchecked with their ego, that is, those are characteristics that it's gone too far. You know, the great one I like is compete with yourself. I mean, again, I think egos also are led to by getting validation for the result, where it's more like we've talked about is being better than yesterday. Compete with yourself, you know, compete for yourself. You know, I think that can help keep an ego in check.
And that's also a more challenging thing to do, to compete with yourself, than it is to compete with others, mainly because, like with the ego, it really is like really important for things like self-esteem and confidence, that kind of stuff. And when you're competing with yourself, you're somewhat, you know, ripping that Band-Aid off all the time. And that's not as great as competing with somebody else and beating them, you know, consistently. So that's why it becomes harder for athletes and stuff to compete with themselves on a daily basis. That doesn't mean that they can't do it. I mean, right, plenty are trained to do it, but it's easier to compete with somebody else than it is yourself.
Yeah, it's more visible, more tangible. I agree. That's a nice perspective and very important, because we do always, I believe we need a scoreboard of some sort to measure how good we're getting, but we usually look at the external one instead of the internal one. And there's a lot of ways in sports, you know, like an example of doing 12 push-ups instead of 10 push-ups the one day or the other. But I think the key to keeping ego from negative is separating it from your identity. And I think that's where, again, an ego unchecked goes, if that becomes their identity. They become not, you know, Stephen Cutter, but, you know, baseball coach or, you know, a star athlete that, you know, that people have identified them as a basketball player or a cross-country runner, and not that particular person. And we've seen, you know, that be too much pressure for some people, you know, to handle and difficult to deal with. We're almost feeding into it. And our society does feed into it because back to being a role model, they are maybe not considered role models, but indirectly people are looking up to them and want to be like them. So especially in the student athletes. So any change of thoughts on if it's positive or negative?
I'm only going to bring this up because usually, like, you tell me after the podcast that you wish I'd brought it up. But I was thinking the most, and this is a fictional character, but a probably good approach or thought process of ego in play would be, and I was trying to look it up, but Charlie Sheen's character, Wild Thing.
Major League?
Yeah, Major League. There you go. And that
great movie.
The process of actually seeing an ego still in play, you know what I'm saying, where he was very selfish in the beginning, blamed other people's for his problems, and then transformed. By the time he was done, he had ego in check, but it was still a part of his character.
Great example. I got a better one, though. Ted Lasso. Because if we're going to mention shows, I mean, but seriously, I traveled this weekend to watch our cross-country team win the national championship.
In the snow.
It was a blizzard. So Fort Dodge, Iowa got a lot of snow this weekend.
I assume you're going to talk about the character of Jamie.
Jamie is the main one throughout the three seasons that they change from being all about him and wanting the ball and wanting to score. And you see that his dad had an important role of you need the goals. And, Ted really worked on him. You know, like one of the lines he said, and I can't remember when they're, you know, you're one in a million, Jamie, but on this team, I need you to be one of 11, you know, and the talent is astronomically high, but we need him to fit on this team to be successful. But it comes down again, checking it. And Ted tried to check it. The manager on Major League worked on checking Wild Things. And the ones that don't are the ones that don't become successful. So ego isn't good or bad. It's more just how we manage. If, you know, a controlled one is good, an unchecked one leads to chaos. So, the best athlete, they walk that line. They're confident, not cocky. They know they're great, but they know there's more to do. And again, it comes back with humility and conviction, and let it be your edge, not your enemy. So I think it is a positive word. I think we, as society, we think of it as a negative word. But I think in sports, it's a necessity to be great, but it's also something you have to manage, because one of my favorite paradoxes, the strength to the extreme becomes a weakness. And that is true for your ego. Balance, right? Anything else on ego, Cut?
No. Nope.
Any good quote then? You started with a great one, man, out of the just blue with an artist.
Can only handle one at a time. So
balance. So, oh, good stuff. And we didn't get no bowling examples today. That's okay. We'll save that for next week. So usually we record this on the day after you have bowling. So
I did bowl and.
Your ego didn't get in the way?
It's bruised.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, we were pretty much at the bottom of the pile. So, seventh place or something like that, I think.
Oh, we got it. It's where you're at today, not to let's get.
That was the first half of the season, too. So, okay. Yeah, we did not win the first half of the season championship.
I think that happened last year, too, and you really can't.
I know. We're notorious for that, actually. It's not intentional. It really is not.
Okay, so let's wrap this up with our food question. I was listening to a podcast on Thanksgiving today, and the podcast mentioned that 60%, I think, of Americans don't like certain traditional Thanksgiving dishes. And I think that's, and 30% are moving away from turkey as their main dish. Pork is number two now, which is interesting to me. Wow. So there you go. Yeah. There you go. Some Thanksgiving facts on Stars on Sports. So, I mean, I saw you shake your head about turkey. That wasn't going to be the question I asked. So,
yams.
But that is. Yams is your least favorite, or?
I don't know. I was just throwing it out there.
Okay.
You didn't ask the question yet.
So I'm going to ask, what is your least favorite Thanksgiving dish? I'll go first. Cranberry sauce. hands down. Mm. And then another one, which is lead to our another question, is like the dish that my family always bring. My wife is famous for green bean casserole. I hate it. Sorry, honey. My kids love it, but that's another one I wouldn't eat. Okay. But that's the one she'll take whenever we go place because everyone else loves it. So, but cranberry sauce is my number one. I won't even touch it.
Yeah. Are you talking about the stuff that comes out of the can? You just plop it out?
Any of that red stuff.
I'll be honest with you. Thanksgiving is one of my least favorite holidays when it comes to food. Okay. I am a notoriously picky eater, and I really do not like any Thanksgiving food whatsoever.
Wow.
I will easily, if I have other options on the table, like if somebody brought tacos, for instance, I would take tacos. Uh-huh. I really don't care for turkey that much. I will eat it, but I don't care for it. And I'm pretty sure I'm safe to do this because I don't think my mom's going to listen to this. I'm going to mention it. She, since I was a kid, used to make this cranberry sauce, and I used to like it quite a bit when I was a kid. As I've grown older, though, I don't care for it. So every year I have to make sure I eat a little bit of it or just tell her, eventually, I don't like this anymore. And it's not so bad that I can't eat it. It's not like that kind of a food, but yeah. Okay. Yeah, I really don't care for Thanksgiving food at all.
Okay, I think more and more people are kind of going towards that belief, according to this podcast. And we'll talk about turkey in our next one, though, but because
I've never done the fried turkey. Has anybody done that?
I have not.
Is that any better?
It's better.
Yeah?
It's better.
We'll talk about that next week.
All right.
We'll talk about turkey. What about you, Cutter?
I think I go back to, to Dalian's making me feel better about my pickiness in food.
I'm picky,
feeling
too.
Better about myself. But, once
helping
again.
Helping your ego a little.
Yeah. Helping the ego.
Well played.
We talk about moms, and my mom is notorious for making these, squash and all, and it just I've let her know it's terrible.
I'll be honest. I didn't even think of the squash. Squash is definitely the worst food out of all.
I don't mind acorn squash with a lot of brown sugar, but you got to have sugar.
It's like you're eating baby food.
Yeah, I agree.
Yes.
Yeah, I went squash went behind my. I was worried you were going to say yams. I actually like sweet potatoes, but I don't eat them a lot. But, good stuff. Again, I don't know how we get going on that thing, but we're going to do it again next week. And until that time, go Stars. Stars on Sports is recorded live at the WLNZ Studios. Engineering and production assistance are provided by Dedalian Lowry, and you can listen to the episode and other episodes of Stars on Sports on demand at lccconnect.org. To find more information about our athletic program, visit lccstars.com. Thanks for listening. Be sure to join us next time for more Stars on Sports.
Go Stars!
Connected with LCC Connect at lccconnect.org.
LCC
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
K-12 Operations at Lansing Community College has been a proud collaborator of the Mason Promise Scholarship since 2016. The Mason Promise Scholarship is a community organization of volunteers that guarantees funding for 2 years of Lansing Community College education to selected Mason Public School students. These selected students are chosen by the Mason Public Schools at the end of the fifth grade and then become a Mason Promise Scholarship through an induction ceremony. Over the course of the next 6 years, these students receive mentoring and support, as well as introduction to career possibilities through the Pathway Program. For more information on the Mason Promise Scholarship at LCC, please visit lcc.edu/hope.
Feeling froggy? Well, leap into 20-plus podcasts at lccconnect.org.
LCC Alumni Stories, a show dedicated to highlighting the amazing alumni of Lansing Community College.
I'm Steve Robinson, president of LCC, and on each episode, I have the awesome privilege of getting to know one of our many inspiring alums and hearing about their experiences at and since leaving LCC.
Listen to this program and many others on demand at lccconnect.org.
This message is for Shauna, my mom, who just finished her high school diploma. I wanted to say I'm so proud of you for finishing school. You taught me it's never too late to achieve your dreams. I hope to make you as proud as you have made me.
When you graduate, they graduate. Finish your high school diploma for you and for them. Visit finishyourdiploma.org to find free and supportive adult education centers near you. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
This has been a presentation of LCC Connect, a weekly program that features the voices, vibes, and vision of Lansing Community College. All shows featured on LCC Connect are recorded at the WLNZ studio, located on LCC's downtown campus. Each program is podcast-based and can be heard anytime at lccconnect.org. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on one of our shows, connect with us by emailing lcc-connect@lcc.edu.